Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week we don't have a theme. Gong gong.
Ba ba ba.
Ian, please make a sound effect. Okay, it's R2.
Wow.
I'm here with C3PO.
I am fluent in over 1,400 billion languages.
Oh God. We're never gonna finish the recording, are we?
We're never gonna start.
Help me on my very lost friends. Ian and Joe, two high school English teachers.
I'm Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. Let me start that again.
Now, is it Joe Holshue?
Joseph Holshue.
Oh.
I'm Joseph Holshue. Joseph Harvey Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, I think a little bit of guidance this week is due. I think you should strap yourself in because Whoa. I brought the right stuff by Tom Wolfe, a book about the Mercury astronauts and the first men in space. Nope, the first American men in space.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And today, Nick, if you're looking for a book about no theme detected, I think you should read Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi because she compares waking up early to being bitten by 55 snakes.
Ian, I lost you there for a second. I'm not sure what theme bringing.
I'm talking about a book about no theme detected.
Oh, dang, it happened again. There must be something going on
it's
Skype
something,
today.
It's I might have a filter in, or maybe I automated this part of it. I can't remember, but
very
whatever. You'll work it out in post, I think.
Post what?
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Congratulations, guys. It took us 14 weeks to get to not coming up with a theme. This is
also 24 minutes to start this episode.
Yes, also relevant to the listener.
Hey, guys, I have a riddle for you. I have a riddle
for you.
I love
riddles.
Okay, do you want to tell it to us now, or are you just letting us know? Okay.
For later.
No, you're just going to bask in this. Until such time as I feel willing.
Are these surprise riddles just going to make us feel dumb?
No, you're going to get this pretty easily, I think.
Okay.
Ooh.
And you may want to take notes.
I'm not going to do that.
Okay. I'm ready.
I have hundreds of heads, but not a single neck. I don't have legs, but I have many feet. A spine I have, but nary a back. And dozens of gutters, but never a street.
It's got to be a book. He said spine.
No. It's got to be a house. Well, hundreds of heads.
Maybe a hotel?
A gutter. So hundreds of heads. Mm-hmm. It's got feet. It's got a spine. And it's got gutters.
Well, okay. I'm sticking with book.
What is hundreds of heads? Zits?
Zits, ooh. Yes.
Yeah, that's... Yep.
Joe just trying to tell one of his bad stories again.
It could be nail heads, like hundreds of nail heads.
Okay, so you're thinking of back to the hotel then.
Well, house, yeah. What about feet?
Do you build a hotel with nails?
Ian, can you say the thing about feet again?
I don't have legs,
slower.
but I have many feet.
Is it a clock? Is it lava?
I have hundreds of heads. I have many feet. I have a spine.
Please, dear God, just tell us.
Joe, do you want to guess something? Or are you good?
He's really trying to get it.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
He's putting effort into this. I appreciate the earnestness of it.
Yeah.
Hey, hundreds of ads.
Joe, why don't we just move on with the podcast and you can keep thinking about it.
All right.
And just yell it out when you get it.
We'll come back to this towards the end. How about that?
All right. I love that. We're going to book on the episode. That's a classic literary technique.
Very fun. Dear audience, we'd love you to play along. You've no doubt already guessed book like I have, or possibly hotel, but if you have it...
Everybody at home is just screaming in their car right now. You idiots!
Book or hotel?
I don't think so. Those are the choices. Guys, before we get going, I just want to go over the show rules. They are simple, but powerful. And we take them very seriously here. So please pay attention.
You don't take him seriously.
Okay. The first rule. What has 100 heads? All right. Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers, Ian. Number two, omit needless words, Joe. And number three, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing.
Thank you.
Yours is about SpaceX, correct, Joe?
Mine is about space, the original SpaceX, the Mercury program.
Fantastic. So why don't you start going with your 30-second plot?
Fantastic.
You already started, so has your timer.
Great. The Right Stuff, Nick, is the story of the test pilots who would go on to become America's first astronauts. Instead of being a dry account, though, it reads like a fiction thriller.
Are you serious?
I can keep going.
That's time.
All right.
Good work, Joe. Very
Thank
good.
Thank you. Always within the time limit.
Ian, your time has already started.
Persepolis is the memoir of an Iranian woman who lived through the Islamic Revolution. It tells the story of her years growing up in Iran before the Ayatollah took over, the departure of her and her family during the revolution, and her attempts to cope with life after uprooting. It's been made into an award-winning movie, banned from classrooms, and received a variety of accolades. Oh, and it's a comic book.
It's a comic book?
It's a comic book.
Nick, I need a rule in on this. Are comic books books?
Wow.
Well, yeah, it's in the name. Dummy.
Oh, that's good.
Please
that's
pay
good
attention.
Point.
Oh, is the riddle, is a comic book? Is that the answer to the riddle?
Are we doing this now?
Hundreds of heads.
We aren't not
many
doing
feet,
it ever.
Spines and gutters.
We are always listening. In graduate school, there was a really annoying phrase that all the critical theorists like to use. It's always already. And it's kind of like this goofy, like people repeat it as a parody of the way critical theory talks. I would say we are always already answering this riddle.
I'm going to be honest. I don't really know what an Ayatollah is, so I'm hoping I can learn a little bit more about that. So, Ian, I'd like you to go first.
Right.
Hoping you can clear this up for me.
add some quick stuff about the Ayatollah. Actually, sorry. Before I go, can I just ask a question that's been bothering me about something Joe said?
Okay.
Oh, boy.
Jesus.
Oh, boy.
Joe, you said test pilots.
Yes.
And I'm wondering whether Tesla is short for Testla.
I don't think so. I think Tesla is just an homage to Nikola Tesla.
Oh, I don't know who that is. Seems like a kind of a loser.
Really? He was like really, really famous.
I know. I'm doing a joke. It's a little comedic joke about the cult of Nikola Tesla.
Oh, yeah, okay. Because he's like, I mean, pretty famous guy.
I bet Elon Musk is kind of a douchebag. Like, isn't Elon Musk really seems like a douchebag, doesn't he?
Yeah, I have a feeling that billionaire Elon Musk is probably pretty out of touch. You're right, Joe.
No, not out of touch. A douchebag. Like, he seems like he sucks.
Aren't douchebags just people that are just a little out of touch, though?
Maybe. I don't know.
Out of touch with being nice.
Yeah. So, speaking of douchebags, Ian, it is your turn. Why don't you go first?
Wow. Okay. Love those segues in this show.
Segue.
Okay, let me tell you some things about this book.
Okay,
just some Please. Fun, some fun facts, some interesting facts.
We didn't get any of those last week.
No, we didn't because the Romeo and Juliet's kind of a downer.
Oh, yeah, we did. That book sucked.
Also, we only know like four things about William Shakespeare for sure. It's like
it's
we know
actually
when he was born. We know when he died. We know like when his kids were born, and I think we know when we got married.
Really.
There are startlingly few pieces. There's like somebody counted them up. There's like 53 hard pieces of evidence about Shakespeare's life. Enough to tell us that we actually like we know he was a person who lived and wrote plays, but not enough to get a good sense of like what he was like. So let me tell you about Persepolis because I love this book and it's a super. There's a lot to get to. So it is, I mentioned in my 30-second rundown, it is a comic book. So. Bold. It's got a bold visual style, black on white, no color, no shading. It's very striking. It is a memoir, nonfiction, drawn and written by Marjane Satrapi. It's kind of her story, and she. This is the entire project is hers. It is a Bildungsroman, like The Wizard of Earthsea. So that friend is back. It was made into a movie. starring Sean Penn and James Newell Osterberg. You guys know James Newell Osterberg.
I do not.
Iggy Pop.
Really? Yeah. That's his real name.
Yes.
I'd like to pause here for a second. Hey, Nick.
Yeah.
Nick, we have a quiz for you. Oh. Ian and I, we put a lot of work into all of these episodes, and I just want to know how much you're retaining week to week.
Great.
God damn it.
Yeah.
Call to the carpet.
His real name is James Newell Ostenberg.
So Persepolis is a building's roman, which of course, Nick, you remember from A Wizard of Earthsea. Nick, can you explain to us what a building's roman is?
That's when it's a real story, but the names and locations have been changed.
So close. I'm so kind of proud of him for getting so close.
Yeah, okay.
It's a Romana Clef, but yeah, really, really close, Nick. Different.
That is really close. All right. Ian, do you want to fill him in?
A building's roman is a story of the coming of age story. Young person coming of age. So
like yeah, Stand By Me or The Sandlot or...
So not like the Colosseum or something.
No, not a Roman building.
That was the lowest kind of pun. I'm going to talk more about this book. So the movie, the book was made into a movie. The English version, there was a French version and an English version because it was originally written in French. The movie, the English version had Sean Penn and Iggy Pop as some of the voices. This movie won the jury prize at the Cannes Film Festival, was nominated for an Oscar, which it lost to Ratatouille. The Iranian government officially protested the screening of the movie at Cannes. In Tunisia, a television station was fined for airing the film by the Islamic government of the area.
Ooh.
So it's a bit of a controversy book. It is part of the kind of serious graphic novel / comic book push, Arch Spiegelman's Mouse. If any of you have read that, it's a kind of in the same vein as Mouse or Watchmen. Or any number of others that are kind of like doing this serious graphic novel thing, but it wasn't a graphic novel, and she's insistent of that. It's really hard to classify this book as far as like fiction versus nonfiction. So the things that she's talking about in the story, this
good job bringing it this week. This is you're right. Like I don't know what you'd fit this into.
It's out of. So there's an element that seems fictional to it, but it's all like her life. It's a memoir in the way that memoirs are remembered, recounted, somewhat kind of fictionalized, but not a fictional story the way, say, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is. So it's a strange book. And one of the things I like the most about it is the comic book tradition that it comes from. So this is something which I learned about when I was preparing for this episode. Do you guys know, have you ever heard the term bande dessinée?
Yeah, bande, like good destiny, good.
Bande dessinée.
Like bon voyage?
I should know the literal meaning of this word, of this phrase. It means drawn strip.
Oh. Okay.
It refers to the comic book style. This is a robust Belgian-French comic book tradition, which is completely separate from the English and American comic tradition. If you have ever read, I'm just going to throw some names out there. If you're familiar with Asterix at all, anyone?
No. Nope.
Tintin.
Yes. Yeah, I've heard of that. Yes.
Or the Smurfs.
Boo. I don't know why, but I hate the Smurfs. Can you shed any light on that, Ian?
Oh boy. These are all Asterix, Tintin, the Smurfs there, and plenty of others. Are all bande dessinée material. Originally, they're published. These are short-ish, self-contained books, but they're longer than U.S. comics. Usually, U.S. comics are 32 pages or so. Bande dessinée are longer than this, and they're printed on larger paper, and they're just hugely influential in French and Belgian culture. Like as cultural things and more broadly as literature, there's like a journalistic tradition critiquing them. There's fan culture. There's cons. Multimedia adaptations, like this is a huge, huge thing. A lot of people refer to Persepolis as a graphic novel. So the author, who seems like just a wonderful person in all the interviews I read with her and so forth, has this to say about the format. The first thing to remember is that it's not a graphic novel. It's a comic. People are so afraid to say the word comic. It makes you think of a grown man with pimples, a ponytail, and a big belly. Change it to graphic novel, and that disappears. No, it's all comics. Movies are all movies. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Orson Welles, one is crap, the other isn't. But they're all movies.
Whoa! How dare she talk about Orson Welles like that?
Ooh, nice. She's insistent.
But that does actually seriously offend me and turns me off to this book and author. Keep going.
She's insistent that this is not a graphic novel. It's she wants to kind of revel in the comic nature.
Sure. She's making a point.
Yeah, right. I'm not sure whether she actually thinks that Orson Welles is a subpar actor, but...
Mm-hmm.
So is comics the big umbrella that graphic novels fall under?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of people say graphic novel, they think of something that's limited run. Something that's collected into a single volume.
Yeah. And when we think of comics, we think of like the Sunday Funnies maybe, or we think of like Spider-Man or something
right.
like that.
Well, there's a sense that comics never end. Like Superman, as long as there are comics, there will be Superman comics. And like the story of Superman won't end. But like Persepolis is a book, and it is a certain number of pages. It's 340 some odd pages, 341 pages. And that's it. Like the story is over.
It's not Marmaduke.
Right. It's very much, I think that's one of the truest things you've ever said, Joe. In so many ways, Persepolis is not Marmaduke.
Oh, wait. I just found a one-star review. Do you guys want to hear this?
I would love
of Marmaduke?
To. All right. One-star review of Ian's book. It just says, is not Marmaduke. Really interesting.
Oh.
Yeah. I think I wrote that. Is it?
I mean,
is
that
it,
is.
What's the screen name?
Dipshit.
Joe, you've got to watch it. You can't set him up like that. Mm-hmm. You just opened yourself up to that.
Does it say my name?
Joe is drinking right there.
Oh boy.
I was. That's why I wasn't responding.
Maybe we could call them just comic novels. Would that make her happy?
I think she just wants it to be called a comic.
Gotcha.
She's really pushing against it. There's this idea that like there are serious comics and genre pulp trash comics. And I think like if you think about this, there are an echelon of graphic novels, we call them graphic novels, that are limited run, deal with like big themes.
Yeah, they're serious.
Yeah, they're serious, prestigious.
Okay, so like with all the streaming services, all these superhero, they have been like releasing all of these superhero, I think you could make the argument graphic novel turned like animated cartoon.
Sure.
And like I turned on the Batman one the other day, and there's like the opening scene is a series of like crime going on through Gotham City.
Yes.
And it is mortifying.
It's like graphic, like intense?
It was, I think a baby died in one scene.
Oh my
god.
Wow. It was just like, oh, very, we get it. It was a very serious topic.
We're really going to push it. We're going to push the envelope.
They underlined graphic. So let's digress.
Please.
What is this about?
So it's the story of this woman's growing up years during the Islamic Revolution. So she's born in Iran before the revolution happens and grows up in this sort of intellectual household. Her parents are both intellectuals. She has like a wide exposure to a variety of philosophical inputs. And when the revolution kind of starts gearing up, she is marching in favor of the revolution. She likes the sound of this because she feels like her culture is stuck in its ways. It's backward. It's problematic. It's got all kinds of repressive elements. It's corrupt. She hates that. And so she thinks the thing that she needs to do is be a revolutionary. So
can we back up just a second?
Please,
so
please
the
do.
Islamic revolution. My understanding is like Islam. I'm sorry, Iranian revolution. My understanding is that at one point, like Iranian had a relatively permissive culture, right? Like I've seen pictures of Iranian women in the 70s wearing bikinis.
Yeah.
Right. And then of course, and then we have like this religious revolution.
Yeah. So it's a really interesting revolution because It took place. Iran had a lot of sort of upheaval every few decades or so. There'd be a change in leadership, oftentimes brought on by foreign powers. The U.S. was very involved. The CIA was very involved in sort of making sure Iran's government was friendly to Iran. And it did have this very permissive sort of secular vibe in especially the 70s. Mm-hmm. And there was a push in the late 70s toward kind of getting rid of this permissive secular environment, because this was connected to heavy dabbling by the U.S. and other powers too. Sure. So there's a sense like
a new government was put into power, right?
Yeah, right. So what happened was the revolutionaries, who were kind of a coalition, ended up ousting the monarch, and he was exiled, and they put into place this theocracy. So total revolution from the sort of permissive thing, and it became very much like it was built on these religious principles. And the really fascinating thing to me, the thing I like hold on to, is that this revolution, the act of revolution, is kind of radical. To say, let us overturn the established order and flip it on its head, is a radical move. Yeah. And the thing that replaced it was
worse.
Even more conservative.
Well, restrictive. It was more restrictive.
Exactly. It was like doing a radical thing to produce further restrictions. And
yeah, I don't think I've ever heard of a revolution that works in that way.
Right. Yeah, you usually think of kind of like greater freedoms, greater liberties. But the really interesting thing is that there is a strong sense that like everyone has their fingers in the pie, and we have to kick them out. We have to make Iran its own thing again. And so the fascinating thing to me is that one of the leaders of the primary revolutionary party, the Ayatollah Khomeini, said to a lot of women in Iran, listen, help us overthrow this current government, and we will give you a leg up. We'll help you. We'll make sure you're good. Kind of promising vague things. And then when the turn happened, when the revolution took place, women found their rights, which they were accustomed to, sort of slipping away.
And that was never planned. Like the rug was pulled out from under them.
Yes, the women were not the women were not like seeking this out. Okay. This is not a sense of like
I want to. If we help them, they'll take away all of our rights.
Sounds
so. It's
just
super. It's such a weird twist, and it's had these huge ripple effects on like the oil industry and on sort of Iranian national identity. The place of Iran in sort of the global arena. And just like in this story, this individual story, we have this young woman who is kind of coming of age as this revolution is happening. She is being a revolutionary, and then she sees, as the revolution happens, she sees her rights starting to be stripped away. And so she has to kind of go through this disillusionment, this revelation, like, oh, this was not what I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. And it really captures the spirit, I think, of like the young person who wants, maybe you guys have been here, maybe you haven't, but like you want a better world. Like you as a young person, you're interested in like, I'm going to march, I'm going to demonstrate, I'm going to protest, I'm going to change the world and make it a better place. And for her, we get to watch her help change the world, or at least change this country, and then realize they were kind of deceived. They had the rug pulled out from underneath them, and the world is seemingly worse. And it's heart-wrenching. It's grim. It's also like really, really funny in parts, which sounds strange to say after all that I just said.
Sounds like
a blast, seriously. Yeah. So like she has these relatives. She's a character in the book, and so her point of view is kind of wry. She has this wry humor. It doesn't really translate to reading aloud, but she has this wry humor which just shows up at the most inopportune moments. And so she can alternate as an author, alternate between this incredible pathos and pain, and then the character, her as a character, her reaction to the world around her is just so pithy and funny and unexpected. It's a work which could very easily be too serious, and she keeps this kind of light tone running underneath throughout the whole thing.
So what's the premise of this? It's not just a political commentary, is it? Like, what's the
premise of the book? It's like her. So it's from her perspective. So it's very much like she's pretty true to telling the story through her own eyes. It was published in two parts, 2004 and 2007. And the first part, at the end of the first part, she goes away to Austria to be safe. And the second part, she's living in Austria and she has to deal with like all the things that go along with, you know, being someone from the Middle East in Europe. So like racism and culture shock and confusion about like religion. There's a whole thing where she experiences the Catholic Church in order to try and fit in. She's at school. There's school stuff. She eventually goes back. So she grows up a bit. She goes back to Iran. And so the first book is all about her sort of negotiating the revolution itself. The second book is all about her seeing Iran, her seeing her home city of Tehran after the revolution, all the things that have changed. So I mentioned like it becomes less permissive. The hijab is this motif that comes up throughout the whole book. And she kind of doesn't really like the idea of it. She's concerned about it. She asks her parents, like, what does this mean? They talk to her about, well, it's about religion. It's about sort of like protection, but she kind of sees through some of the rhetoric of it. She comes back and she sees like the way the culture has changed so dramatically. And it makes me think, I've lived in a relatively stable culture my whole life. What would it be like to see my culture shift like on a dime? So like within the span of a couple of years, go from extremely permissive to extremely restrictive. I think a lot of times those changes are much more slow. So it's fascinating to see like she has to cope with what is it like? Who am I now? What is this place now? Is this my home anymore? And eventually she has to leave. Like she does. That's not her home.
You know, there must be a whole generation of women who left Iran. I would almost think because of this conflict that and they all had to experience this. Like they're growing up in a permissive time. They're growing up in like the almost hyper permissive 70s, right? While their country is headed in the other direction. And at a certain point, like something has to give, right? And I think like leaving makes sense.
Is this a book that you should read if you want to learn about the Iranian Revolution or what is this? Is this yes? I assume yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Or I mean, are there better ones?
This book is useful as a way into the Islamic Revolution, and I'm referring to it as the Islamic Revolution because this is the accepted nomenclature for it. And from the perspective of a lot of folks within Islamic communities, this is a really good thing, a really exciting thing. Like this is what Islam could do for a country is make it more kind of independent of its neighbors. Anyway, that's a little sidetrack. This book is a good entry point into the Islamic Revolution, but it's also just a really, really powerful story of one person confronting change in their life and honestly not always dealing with it super well. One of my favorite things about this book is she messes up. She responds in sort of not the best ways. She makes mistakes. And so, yes, it stretched me. It taught me history. It gave me a sense of kind of what of an Iranian national identity beyond like the other, the big bad, the axis of evil. But this story gives a different view of like the people who lost stuff and the reasons why people ushered in this new regime. People were really, really invested in it. It wasn't a situation of a hostile takeover. People really, really wanted this. The world is a richer place, I think, for having this particular individual story in it. And it's a comic book, and the art's really good.
Robot noises. Hey guys.
What's up?
That's his catchphrase.
What's up? Hey guys.
Can we get t-shirts printed with that?
Guys, what do you want to do next week? I was thinking we could do a book about angry robots. What do you think about that?
Yeah, maybe sad robots.
Hungry robots.
Horny robots.
Nope.
Do you think there's ever been a horny robot book?
Almost certainly there has.
Hold on. I bet there's a lot of horny robot stuff on like Wattpad or like fan fiction sites.
But they're all with pictures.
Let's not do that.
Love Machine, an erotic robot romance book.
Did you just Google horny robot book?
It's $0 on Kindle right now. You can get it.
Oh, fantastic. I know a book I'm bringing next week.
This week we're sponsored by them, right?
No.
What if instead of highly erotic robot books, we do fun robot books?
Oh, fun robot books. That sounds good.
Like lighthearted robot books or like happy robot books?
Robot books that are fun to read instead of a huge drag and misery.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times these robot books are like the end of the world, robots take over, robots don't have souls, robots do have souls. I don't want a book where robots are like really, really miserable.
Sometimes they're thinking about having a soul and then they decide not to.
Right. They're like, I'm out of the soul biz. Right.
So fun robot books.
Fun robot book.
Do you have any that come to mind?
I'm going to bring the book Metropolis by German author Thea von Harbou.
Ooh. And I'm going to bring the book We Are Legion, We Are Bob by Canadian author Dennis E. Taylor. Famous Canadian author.
Multicultural.
I've never heard of him before.
Yeah, well, you will.
Let's take a break right now. Let's check in with Joe and see if he has any guesses.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Let's get a riddle update.
Okay. I'm really stuck on the house thing because like a house has hundreds of nail heads. It is on like the thing that your basement is on are called footings. Like you pour footings to build your house.
He doesn't
your roof
know.
Your roof has a spine and it has gutters.
He's repeating the question. You know, when you're in the front of the classroom, when your students get up and you're...
I guess
and
house.
Your guess is a house.
My guess is a house.
Congratulations, Nick. You've bullied Joe into making a guess.
Joe heard gutters and he thought house and I heard spine and I thought book. Plus, it's a literature podcast.
You guys are just ignoring the heads and feet. Just to be clear, you're just pretending that parts
headers
of the riddle don't exist.
Headers. Sweet Jesus, Ian, please just fucking tell us what the answer is.
I think it's books.
I'll tell you at the end of the episode.
Oh, God, instead, you suck.
Instead, right now, I'll give you a Hobbit fact. The least desired Hobbit fact ever. We've been talking about comic books, and I will tell you that in 1989, a limited run comic book adaptation of The Hobbit came out. It's three episodes. It's three issues, and it is actually pretty good. I have read it. It's not quite the style of the animated Lord of the Rings Hobbit movies, which came out in the early 80s, and it's obviously not as it's not live action Hobbit movies from the turn of the millennium, but it's not bad. It's pretty good.
Not bad. Pretty good.
Sounds pretty good.
I mean, I'm not going to say it's, you know, worthy of a Pulitzer Prize.
Joe.
I'm ready.
Is this about going to space?
This is about the very first Americans that went to space or that tried to go to space or that many succeeded. Many eventually succeeded. All right. A little bit of an overview. The Right Stuff is a book by a guy named Tom Wolfe. And you might kind of be aware of who Tom Wolfe is.
Is this Dick Wolfe's brother?
He might be.
Dick Wolfe? Wait, is this Law and Order?
Gung gung.
So Tom Wolfe is Dick Wolfe's brother, but he only wears a white suit. He's eccentric in that way. He
only wears a white suit like to bed, to the shower. What is this?
Well, if you Google Tom Wolfe, if you Google Tom Wolfe, every photo that you see of him nearly will be him wearing a white suit. It was kind of his thing, which is like kind of cool and kind of pretentious, but that's Tom Wolfe's thing, right? Like cool and pretentious is like the Tom Wolfe style.
Great. I just want to share a point about, can I give you guys a fun fact about Dick Wolfe?
Yeah, please. Thank God.
So there's a new Law and Order coming out at some point in the future called Law and Order Hate Crimes, which was going to be a spinoff of the Law and Order universe, the Law and Orderverse, but NBC decided that the concept wasn't strong enough, and so it wasn't going to go forward. And then eventually got moved to the Peacock network because they realized if you're going to do hate crimes, you're going to have a lot of language, and you can't have that language on broadcast TV. So that's my Dick Wolf. That's my Dick Wolf fact for the day.
Are we brushing over the hate that's called hate crimes?
It is.
Subtle.
Law and Order. Relevant.
So Tom Wolfe was famous. He was like this consummate New Yorker, right? And in 1962, he bought a white suit to wear in the summer months, but he found that it was too heavy to wear in the summers. So he started wearing it year round. But in New York, on the Upper East Side where he lived, that created quite a stir that he was wearing a white suit past Labor Day.
Because in New York, they had nothing better to do than be mad about a guy wearing a white suit.
Yeah, and Tom Wolfe kind of leaned into it. No, not much. He leaned into it a little bit, and he proceeded to wear only white suits for public appearances for the remainder of his life.
Wow.
So Tom Wolfe is this pretty, kind of famous writer. Like, I think there's a good chance you've heard his name. You've probably heard books that he's written. The Right Stuff is probably his third most famous book, I'm going to go ahead and say. His most famous, I think, is probably The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, where he follows Ken Kesey? Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters as they drive their van around and distribute LSD. And then he also wrote a novel called The Bonfire of the Vanities, which was about the hollowness of wealthy culture in New York City. Bonfire of the Vanities, of course, was made into a film, which made Tom Wolfe gobs and gobs and gobs of money.
So here's the thing. I've never heard of either of those before, but I have heard of The Right Stuff. So
really? Tom Wolfe is a journalist by trade. And he's very famous for inventing this breed of journalism called new journalism. And it's actually not unlike Hunter S. Thompson. Hunter S. Thompson with his gonzo journalism, where he throws himself into these situations. What Tom Wolfe does is he writes about whatever a journalist would write about, in this case, the Mercury program. And he writes about it, but he writes about it in a way that has a lot of literary elements to it.
Ooh, so making it boring.
No, the opposite. He leans into character. He obsesses over things like what people are wearing. He inserts symbols, or he tries to find symbols in people's lives. He writes with things like onomatopoeia and alliteration, right? Like, he writes in a very literary style as he kind of explores these journalistic topics. And one thing that he says is he thinks that journalism is he thinks that doing this to journalism, he is doing a service to journalism, because journalism is this thing that's kind of been pushed to the wayside a little bit. It's very seen as boring, like this who, what, when, where, why, just the facts, ma'am. And he says, well, no, journalism is about the world that we live in. And that world deserves to be honored with the best that we have. So it should be treated like literature. And the result is this pretty engaging, but very often showy, and sometimes by critics seen as over the top prose that he writes about, or that he uses when he writes.
What is it called?
New journalism.
N-U?
Nope, N-E-W.
Okay.
Just like new metal. Okay.
Well, that's interesting. Was any of that published, or was that just his own writings? Or
everything that Tom Wolfe published would be under this umbrella of new journalism.
Oh, okay.
And in a lot of ways, the literary nonfiction that's famous today, people like Michael Lewis, books like Moneyball, or books like The Big Short, they have Tom Wolfe to thank. Moneyball or The Big Short, these things are both made into films. These things are journalistic at their heart, but they're told in an incredibly narrative way. We get to know characters. We spend time with them. We do deep dives into their lives, right? These tales are engrossing. They're captivating. There's tension. It's not just these journalistic accounts of the Oakland A's or the Wall Street crash and the 2008 financial crisis, right? It is this literary account of it.
So like it's these books that you read it and then you get done with it and you're like, oh, heck, I had a lot of fun. And also that was true.
Yeah, that's exactly how this feels. It's like, wow, I'm learning about the Mercury space program and it is a blast to read.
Oh, good. Because of like rocket launching.
Yeah, thank you. So like more where that came from.
So like Aaron Sorkin would like is he like the second coming?
It does feel a little Sorkin-esque. Yeah, it kind of does.
Okay, don't act so surprised.
I hadn't made that connection, but yeah, it does feel a little Sorkin-esque, right?
So what's the book about?
So the book follows the selection of the nine, or I'm sorry, the book seven. Follows the selection of the seven. Seven, thank you.
Fact-checking.
The book follows the selection of the seven Mercury astronauts as they were chosen and then went through their training. And ultimately, the climax of the book is to see who was chosen to be the first American in outer space. The interesting parts of the book really comes from following the lives of these seven characters, diving into their backgrounds, figuring out where they came from, figuring out what qualified them to be astronauts, and then telling the stories of their lives.
Guys, just a brief pause. I put in the chat the cover, the first cover that never made it to print. It's extremely awesome. Like 1970s. My goodness.
I think it's awesome. Like I saw
it's lovely. It's incredible.
Describe it to us, Ian.
Well, so there's some classic 1970s blobby writing superimposed on a pile of orange and red ground beef. Behind that is a metal sculpture with a star. And the star fits nicely, the tip of the star fits nicely into the W, the divot in wolf. So it's very much like, unless you know what this book is about, you won't understand the concept. But once you do, it's actually pretty great because this is a book about the ground beef that was laid as an offering at the foot of a metal statue.
Yeah, and just to elaborate on what Ian says there.
Please do.
Yeah, the ground beef at the bottom is obviously rocket exhaust, and the statue is the ascent of a rocket ship. But I totally agree with Ian that if you didn't know this book was about space travel, this cover would not tell you that it was about space travel. If you did know, it's kind of a cool stylistic cover.
Yeah, I love it.
Maybe we'll post that on our internet social media.
Ooh, heck.
Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
The book premise is very simple. Seven dudes are selected to possibly be the first American in space. They're all going to be astronauts, but one of them is going to be first. The book follows the lives of those seven dudes as they prepare and as they compete with one another to win that honor of being the first guy, the first American citizen to go up in a rocket ship.
Oh, because the rocket ship can only fit one person?
Well, so now when we think of space travel, we of course think of the space shuttle or SpaceX or something along the lines.
I think of that guy, some rando who shot a car into space. I don't know who it was. But
that's what you think of when you think of space travel?
Immediately.
Wow. So now when we think of space travel, we think of like manned aircraft, right? Like we think of a space shuttle going up, which of course has a crew on it. The first rockets that went into space would not have a crew on them. They were essentially airplanes heavily modified and strapped to the back of a massive explosive Roman candle, right? Like that's what the first space travel was. And in fact, the very first people in space, they didn't orbit initially. They just were shot up into the air in this long parabola, right? They shot up into the air where they broke the stratosphere.
Sounds right.
Yeah, we'll say stratosphere. They were shot up into the air where they broke the stratosphere. had weightlessness for X amount of seconds, but the only true like space flight that they had is the weightlessness that they experienced as the rocket went from going up in the air to crashing back to Earth.
Huh.
I think this book has the best cold opening I've ever read in a book.
I've never heard of a book having a cold open.
Yeah, it's a weird way to think about it, but I think it's exactly how it functions. The entire first chapter starts out and it interlaces all these reporters sitting in this this woman's living room. And it like talks about it from the woman's point of view and this chaos of these reporters coming in and the questions that they're asking her. And it interlaces scenes of that with scenes of horrific accidents from test flight pilots.
Test flight pilots?
Yeah. So like, okay, all of the Mercury astronauts were taken from test flight programs, which is essentially the United States would have an idea for an airplane. They would figure out the engineering and then they would have to build it. And then they had to test it and they needed men to fly these planes. It was unbelievably dangerous. If you served out your military career as a test flight pilot, your mortality rate was 54%.
That seems high.
Like, that seems nuts, right? All of the Mercury astronauts were taken from this pool of test flight pilots.
Why would you want to do that?
So, you want to do it because you are made of the right stuff. They loved it. They absolutely lived for it. And they lived for it through and through to every man. They absolutely loved it, for at least for our Mercury astronauts.
What is the right stuff?
So the right stuff is the stuff that makes you a success.
Is it like clay?
The right stuff is the stuff that makes you or anybody a successful pilot. And it cannot be taught. All right? It can only be something you are born with. At a certain point, like in this field, in this test flight program, like people flame out. People crash because of human error. And anytime somebody crashes, anytime somebody dies because of human error, all the other test pilots like obviously have to reconcile this and they have to look at this and like they have to say, well, that might be me. But they all look at it and they say, you know, I think he just didn't have the right stuff. Right. And that's like this phrase that comes up over and over and over again. In fact, it's so ingrained. It's such
like a
natural.
Joke?
No, it's not a joke. It's like an ethos that runs through these fighter pilots. It comes down to even little things in the book, like all of the Mercury pilots, every single one of them drives a brand new Corvette, because of course that's what a Mercury pilot drives, right? Because like, why would you drive anything else if you have the right stuff?
Are they all filthy rich? Like, are they just being compensated just obnoxiously?
It's really unclear. They're all career military. So I don't
think
they're
just
filthy.
Like just junkies. Like adrenaline junkies.
They're like adrenaline junkies. That's the best way to think of it, probably. They're all career military. And in fact, they all look down a little bit on John Glenn. And John Glenn is, of course, famous, Nick, because he is, spoiler alert for U.S. history, John Glenn will eventually be the first American shot into space.
Would he use those words? Shot into space?
So, yes.
Catapulted.
Yes, they do use the word shot into space, catapulted into space. When other pilots were asked, are you mad that you weren't chosen to fly the first Mercury missions? The other pilots would say, you don't fly a rocket, you ride a rocket.
Mm.
And that is absolutely true. Even to the point where like in the Mercury program, like they only give the guys limited control. Like sometimes they give them like fake controls fake buttons, because like pretty much they need somebody to ride these spacecraft. They need somebody to help it descend in a lot of cases. But once they light them off, they just go into the air. Back to the cold opening. That's it.
So like I have these we have these chairs that we put our baby in. Yep. And they have all these like toys that hang down that like mirrors and like little spinny things and things that light up. Is it kind of like that?
I think it is basically like that, like buttons that light up, they click and clack and they feel very satisfying. Yes.
They have a little squeaky hammer.
Nick, I'm a bit concerned that your child's chair will detonate and launch into the air, into the stratosphere. Is this, can you confirm or deny that?
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see if she has the right stuff. We don't know yet.
or flames out. So this cold opening, it shows all these like horrific flight accidents, right? Interlaced with this woman giving this interview in the living room. And they keep asking the woman, the reporters keep asking the woman these questions. They're like, are you scared? Are you scared for your husband's life? And the way that the chapter ends is her saying, why would they ask that now? Like, of course I'm scared, but I've been scared for his life the entire time he's been doing this job. Like, the Mercury mission is incredibly dangerous, but it is no more dangerous than any other test flight mission we've ever done. Nick, I think you should read this book because it makes astronauts cool again. Nick, what do you think of astronauts?
No. Were they ever not cool?
I think a lot of times NASA especially, has like manicured astronauts to the point where I can't imagine an astronaut saying something controversial, right? I can't imagine an astronaut doing something that they're not supposed to do. Like, astronauts seem like these good old American boys.
They would never be on Law and Order hate crimes is what you're saying.
No, they would never have reason to. But this astronaut, or this book, it really humanizes astronauts. And it doesn't just humanize them. It really paints these guys as these bravado-laced, like, space cowboys.
Are they
right?
Frontiers? Like, yeah, I was going to say, are they kind of like the cowboys of space?
Yeah, they really are. Like,
hey, Joe, is there any, like, high drama in this thing? Is there any, like, you know, edge of your seat? Or is it all this, like, very interpersonal... Is it all just very, very like interpersonal stress and anxiety and competition? Like, what's the balance of sort of psychological interest with narrative, just narrative funk?
I think it is a lot of, I think the draw of this book is psychological interest, and we do get the characters, but when they compete with each other, like, some of them are like kind of chummy with each other, but we don't see that much character interaction. We dive into the backstories of each one of these characters as individuals and explore them as individuals kind of going against this race or competing for this position.
Whose point of view is this from?
It is a totally omniscient narrator.
It's from the point of view of the moon.
It's from the point of view of Tom Wolfe is what it is, right? Tom Wolfe is this omniscient narrator.
Was
like
he
telling
given
you about
access?
All these guys. Yeah, he was, extensive access. And in fact, he drafted this book talking only to the Mercury astronauts. And then somebody looked at it and they're like, hey, you should have Chuck Yeager take a look at this. And he gave it to Chuck Yeager. And Chuck Yeager was like, yeah, this is bullshit. Let me tell you why those guys are pansies. and Wolf did a pretty extensive rewrite of the book based on Chuck Yeager's notes.
Wait, Chuck Yeager comes off pretty good here. Wait, and Chuck Yeager got rejected from this project, right?
Well, Chuck Yeager was not chosen. It's not exactly that he like applied and got rejected. It's just that he was not chosen in the initial seven.
Joe, I have a question for you. There are seven cast members, correct?
Sure.
Do 54% of them die?
No, most do okay. Most don't actually die in the Mercury program. The United States has the United States has a vested interest in like the astronauts were a big PR thing. Like, it was a huge PR push with these astronauts, and the United States really did not want them to die.
You know, when it's PR for the government, it's called propaganda.
That's the first two letters of propaganda. Propaganda.
Propaganda. That's where the word, public like propaganda.
That's a good quote.
Joe, congratulations.
Oh my God.
If this was the week to win, you've gone and done it.
Before we get to a quote, I do think we need to come back to the riddle.
Oh, yes, please.
Nick, you're saying it's a hotel. Joe, you're saying it's a house. The correct answer is a book. Books, pages have heads.
It was a book.
And technically, the place on the in the book where like pages come together, like the inside of the spine, right? If you open up a book And like the place of the pages come together, it's really hard to describe. That's called the gutter. So I'm sorry you guys are both wrong. Next week to hear another one, another riddle that these guys will guess wrong.
Okay, this is during the cold open that this comes. This quote comes to you during the cold open. And they're basically what's happened is there's been a bunch of commotion. Like they test all these planes at a certain spot, and all of a sudden there's a bunch of commotion out in the field. The commotion at the field was over one of the most extraordinary things that even veteran pilots had ever seen at Pax River. And they all had seen it because practically the entire flight line had gathered out in the field for it, as it had been an air show. Conrad's friend Ten Whelan had taken a fighter up, and on takeoff there'd been a structural failure that caused a hydraulic leak. A red warning light showed up on Whelan's panel, and he had to talk with the ground. It was obvious that the leak would cripple the controls before he could get the ship back down to the field for the landing. He would have to bail out. The only question was where and when. And so, they had to talk about that. They decided that he should jump at 8,100 feet at such and such speed directly over the field. The plane would crash into the Chesapeake Bay, and he would float down in the field just as coolly as anyone could have asked for it. Ted Whelan lined up the ship to come across the field at 8,100 feet precisely, and he punched out, ejected. Down on the field, they all had their faces turned up to the sky. They saw Whelan pop out of the cockpit with his Martin Beaker seat parachute ring strapped on. He looked like a little black geometric lump a mile and a half up in the blue. They watched him as he started dropping. Everyone waited for the parachute to open. They waited a few more seconds, and then they waited some more. The little shape was getting bigger, and then bigger, and picking up tremendous speed. And then there came an unspeakable instant at which everyone on the field who knew anything about parachute jumps knew what was going to happen. Yet even for them, it was an unearthly feeling, for no one had ever seen any such thing happen so close up, from start to finish, from what amounted to a grandstand seat. Now the shape was going so fast and coming so close that it began to play tricks on the eyes. It seemed to stretch out, it became bigger, it hurtled toward them at terrific speed until they couldn't make out its actual outlines at all. Finally, there was just a streaking black blur before their eyes followed what seemed like an explosion. Except that it was not an explosion. It was the tremendous crack of Ted Whelan. His helmet, his pressure suit, his seat pressure, parachute rig, smashing into the center of the runway, precisely on target, right in front of the crowd. An absolute bullseye.